Wait, hold on. Can I tell you guys what I've been up to?
Yeah. Yes, please. For the love of God.
I'm in Edinburgh. I went skiing over the weekend, even though it's not snowing here. The Scots picked a mountain or a hill or something. There's probably some weird word, Celtic word for it. But there's this thing called the Pentlands that's south of town. And they got what appears to be thousands and thousands and thousands of toilet brushes that they just sewed into the side of the hill so that you could ski down at any time. And it works. But as you're skiing down it, you realize, oh, if I trip and fall, I am going to abrase all of my face off. This is not going to be downy, soft snow because I'm basically running down an entire hill of toothbrush bristles, except a little bit more intense. And the other thing is they have a different kind of chairlift than we've got. Like in America, we just have these chairs that are on suspended pulleys. You've seen them, right? Like in Colorado. What they got in Scotland is they have this frisbee that's stuck to a broom handle, and that's tethered to the pulley thing. And you just kind of squat on that, and then it pulls you up, but your feet stay on the ground. So when you watch, it looks like there's these really lazy witches that are just kind of skimming up the hill and then riding down this trail of toothbrush bristles. Anyway, that's what I did over the weekend.
That sounds adorable.
Yeah.
It's adorable. It was really funny. It was very funny.
How much is it? Is it expensive or is it a working man's hobby?
Working man's hobby. It was like 15, 20 quid. And also the other fun part about this, zero effort at safety or legality. There was none of that. Like if you were going to do dry slope skiing in America, you'd have to sign waivers, get it notarized, call the governor. The governor would assure them, you know how to ski. Like with this one, I was like, hey, can I go skiing? And they're like, do you know how to ski? And I was like, yeah, I went one time 10 years ago. And they're like, all right, fine. So went on the hill. Like that was it. That was the extent. Like they didn't even have anybody at the lift. Like there's nobody watching it.
It sounds like this is more like a skate park for adult alcoholics who have planks of wood.
Yes, that is. I think that is in fact their motto. This is a skate park for adult alcoholics with planks of wood. Yeah.
My name is Justin Robert Young.
I'm Jen Briney.
And I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong. Again, scattered across the globe, Jen Briney back in Warsaw. Andrew Heaton back. No, not in Warsaw. Where are you now?
I'm in Krakow now, which is
the Cleveland of Poland.
I loved Krakow. I got kicked out of a casino in Krakow because I had an iPod and they weren't popular there yet. And so they thought I was cheating at cards and it was a radio transmitter.
Well, times have changed because one of the things that I'm loving about this place is that there's so many people like biking and running and there's like no cars here. And just crazy architecture and a million places to eat and drink outside. I'm in heaven. And it's like 80 degrees. It's perfect here. I love it.
Yeah. Krakow was gorgeous because it wasn't touched by the war, right?
Yeah.
Like it still retains all the architecture that existed beforehand. I'm very excited. That was one of my favorite cities when I was in Poland. I'm very jealous. Heaton, you are ensconced back in Edinburgh. How are you?
I'm firmly ensconced. It's great. The temperature is temperate and low. I've been working out of the Royal Scots Club, which is where I just it's basically my co-working space. But yesterday, I got adopted by a group of older gentlemen in three-piece suits. They have a discussion group on Tuesdays, so I'm going to go do that. I was like, this is good prep work. And then today, I got adopted by like the young bucks who are under 40 and they meet on Fridays. So I have like a whole burgeoning social life going on here.
Yep. With men from the Royal Scots Club.
No, hold on. There's some ladies in the young bucks group.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I haven't met them all yet, but there's a Swiss lady.
There is. I'm sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is she like the girlfriend from Canada? Like, is that just like,
No. You were absolutely correct in stuffy, old and white. This is correct for the majority of the club. However, it is gender balanced. Let's at least give them that.
Okay. I didn't know. I didn't know how, when I think stuffy, old and white clubs, I did not realize there was going to be gender parity. My apologies to the Royal Scots Club for being hasty
in my
judgment on this edition of the program. We are going to talk about the collision course of veterans, the Senate, and celebrity politics. Mrs. Pelosi going to Taiwan and the Forward Party coming together on all three flanks in the Washington Post editorial section. Let's begin with something that a lot of you guys might have seen some coverage of over the last week. Indeed, it was the confluence of congressional bullshit, the American treatment of veterans, and the lingering love for The Daily Show in the mid-2000s. A bill to help fund treatment for veterans affected by burn pits stalled in the Senate after Republicans balked at one of their own amendments not being considered. This led to Jon Stewart, beloved host of the Comedy Central late night stalwart Daily Show and current podcaster, using his celebrity to blitz every television network that would have him to blister the politicians who didn't move it forward.
America's heroes who fought in our wars, outside sweating their asses off with oxygen, battling all kinds of ailments, while these motherfuckers sit in the air conditioning, walled off from any of it.
The bill is not dead per se, but it was not voted on when it should have been voted on. Jen, as you are wont to do, you read the damn thing. What is your take on all of this?
Yes, so we do have some relatively breaking news, which is that they reintroduced it in the Senate and it passed. I know 86 people supported it. Nothing changed whatsoever from the version that was filibustered by the Republicans. And so this is on its way to Biden's desk. It will be law in the next couple of days. So that's what really matters. And having read it, I am...
So Jon Stewart did it.
He did. And God bless him. He's been working on this for years. I've seen him testify about this. Like, you know, he leaves The Daily Show and this is what he worked on. Like, I love that man 100%. So I'm happy that he pulled this off. And the media blitz that he went on after the filibuster was quite impressive. And he didn't just go to the places that are, you know, liberal friendly. He was on Newsmax and Fox News, and he went to anyone that would take
it was
his
everywhere.
Call.
Everywhere that wanted to talk to Jon Stewart on his cell phone, he would turn his cell phone on so he could be on. And he was very on message. The fact that it was the story that it was led to a lot of the other veterans also doing television hits where this was a we don't care about what the issue was, this needs to pass. Can you shed any light on what that issue was? Because I still don't know that I really understand it.
Okay. So there's what the Republicans said was the issue, and then there's what I'm pretty sure the actual issue was. So let's start with what they said, because it's like germane to the bill. So the bill itself, let me just get it out there really quick that it's great for veterans. So it's going to cover all kinds of different cancers. It's going to stop the burden from being on the veterans to prove that their exposure to the burn pits was the cause of their cancers. Now it's like, if you're a veteran, you served in these places in these very broad date ranges and you have cancer, it's covered. Done. So I loved the substance of the bill. This is one that I took the time and I read the entire thing. And I did not see any, not one thing that didn't belong in there that wasn't connected to the veterans. Every single dollar is guaranteed to be spent on the veterans the way that it's spent or the way that it's written. And the issue was Pat Toomey. He's a senator from Pennsylvania, and he voted no every single time this came up for a vote. So at least he was consistent. But essentially what Toomey was trying to do was take this fund that they created to fund all of these, you know, new veterans healthcare bills. This is a fund that is going to be mandatory spending, meaning that when the government fails to be funded every September 30th every year and they dick around and they have government shutdowns and all that, this will not be affected. So the treatment for these veterans will not be held hostage to any congressional shenanigans. And nothing Toomey did would have changed that, by the way. What Toomey wanted to do, though, was change the bill that instead of it saying whatever the Veterans Administration tells Congress that they want for this fund every year, which Congress does have to approve, but there's no limit on what that amount is. So the Veterans Administration can come up with the number that they need, discuss it with Congress, and get that appropriation. Toomey wanted hard limits for the next 10 years. And then he wanted that cap to only be raised after that with the consumer price index. So essentially what he was saying is he wanted price caps. And then if they needed more money than what Toomey was willing to provide, then they would have to go through that whole rigmarole process that they do every September 30th, get the funding, have it go through the appropriations, the shutdowns, the nonsense, and all of that stuff. So essentially, Pat Toomey has been fighting the whole time for caps on the funding. And so what happened was when it came up for the vote the second time, because it had passed the Senate, this current version passed the Senate overwhelmingly with 84 votes. It went back to the House and they changed one sentence that had to do with taxing future employees of the VA. It was a nothing burger of a sentence, nothing to worry about. But they changed that one sentence. And so because it had to go back to the Senate, that's where all of this got held up. The Senate was essentially voting on the same bill they had the last time. But it's the timing on this that matters. So Mitch McConnell had told Chuck Schumer and the Democrats that we are thinking about holding up the semiconductor bill if you even consider doing anything for the climate with your reconciliation bill. So when Joe Manchin went out in the media, we talked about this extensively.
Well, and let me set this up a little bit more, because the CHIPS bill, which is the big semiconductor thing, which I would love for you. I've been looking forward to the Jen Briney readout on that bill since it first surfaced like a year ago. I think I might have even texted you about it. But the Republicans voted for that because they believed Joe Manchin had bailed on the reconciliation thing. They get the Republican votes on that. All of a sudden, Joe Manchin comes back to the table. It looks like the Democrats are going to push through this reconciliation, climate change, anti-inflationary, blah, 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 a bill that they are going to do. But that means that you have a very, very upset cocaine Mitch.
Exactly. And a couple of hours later, this bill comes up for a vote. And so the conventional wisdom in Washington, coming from pretty much everyone I trust, the people at Politico that have been walking around talking to people, the conventional wisdom is that this was a revenge vote, that they wanted to deny the Democrats a win because they were so pissed off about being tricked into voting in for the CHIPS bill that they decided to just make this bill harder. Now, it didn't go well for them, hence the reversal. But the substance for the last week, everything they said was in this bill. So they said it was stuffed full of pork and that there was a slush fund worth $400 billion. I read every word. All of those were lies. All of those were lies. So that's why I'm landing on this as a revenge bill, because I don't actually believe that any of these people hate veterans or anything like that. I think it was a revenge vote. And yeah, they had to pull it back after the media firestorm. And now the bill will be law, which is great for veterans.
I want a clarifying question. It was my understanding, and I do not know as much about this as you do, Jen, that Toomey was trying to make sure that the spending would remain discretionary. There were $40 billion are allocated for this that would be discretionary and not mandatory. You're saying that is not the case, because I thought that was the Toomey amendment, was keeping it discretionary rather than mandatory.
Nope, it was a lie. So the funding that like I said, he put spending caps in his amendment for the next 10 years. And all of that would remain mandatory. What he wanted to be discretionary is if they needed money above that, then that would be discretionary. So basically, like, let's say that there's, I'm pulling a number out of my butt, but like $10 billion for 2023. And the VA comes and says, we need $20 billion in order to cover all of the vets that are showing up with cancer. The $10 billion that Toomey allowed, that would be mandatory. That language didn't change at all. But above his caps would be discretionary.
Whereas now it's just unlimited, where the Veterans Administration can say, we want X amount of money?
No. So the way it works is there's a fund. And every single year, the Veterans Administration has to go to the Appropriations Committee and say, this is how much we want in the fund. But once the money is in the fund, they can spend it as they please. Now, one of the ways that this was twisted by Republicans is they're saying right now the VA is covering people that do have some cancers. The few that were able to prove that the burn pits caused their cancers, like, they're using their discretionary funds to cover these people. So the fear or whatever by the Republicans is that they're going, that the VA is going to take those bills and push them into the fund and therefore have all this extra money in discretionary that then they're going to get to spend on whatever they want. They're completely leaving out the fact that discretionary funding is something that has to be done year after year. And therefore, if a lot of money is moved over into the fund, well, then they can change the discretionary amount. Like Congress still ultimately determines how much money.
Wait, can I pause you? Cause I want to make sure I understand this. So all of the new spending that's coming out of this, even though it's mandatory spending, it's mandatory entitlement spending, but it's being taken out of a discretionary fund.
No. So when you make,
or is the discretionary fund just for the stuff above the mandatory spending?
So the mandatory spending is, think of it like a money bucket where the money doesn't disappear. So like once the money's in the fund, the VA gets to decide how it gets allocated to pay for these veterans' healthcare. And they were very specific that it has to be for these specific veterans with these 31 cancers and these specific ailments. Like it has to be for that. No wiggle room. The discretionary funding is the stuff that is allocated every September 30th-ish to the Veterans Department. Toomey, had he been effective, which he wasn't, would have made sure that some of that money bucket over there would have disappeared. So by making it discretionary, that the funding, there would be a path for it to run out, is essentially what matters. It being all mandatory, that just means that once the money is allocated, it sits there and it can be used. So basically, it's not unlimited.
Yeah, politically, it sounds like if you are making a portion of this discretionary, then you are raising the stakes on things like government shutdowns, because that's when it would be affected, right? So it would be, not only are you shutting down the government, but you're also denying veterans cancer treatment or whatever.
Correct. And the way that it's not unlimited, the way that that's a lie, is that every single year, the VA is going to look at the money they have in the fund, look at the number of veterans that are lined up out the door trying to get cancer treatments, and they're going to have to go every year to the Appropriations Committee and say, this is how much we need. And every year, Congress is going to say yes or no or negotiate or whatever. But every single year, that funding is going to have to be approved by Congress. So the idea that it's just this unlimited thing, like that's just not the case. It just means that the money won't disappear once it's allocated.
Heaton, as much as that sounds very good, and especially for the folks who have served in our military, there should be probably broader application of taking care of them, if they have something like cancer. I will also mention, it has been something that has been said both privately and at sometimes publicly, that Joe Biden believes his son, Beau, died of cancer that he got from a burn pit. That being said, sounds like Toomey was playing entitlement defense, and boy, is it going to be hard for Congress to not approve any number for something as sympathetic as veterans' cancer.
Well, so a couple of things. First of all, I do not have granular knowledge of this, as Jen clearly does. So I defer to her on the mechanics of this, but I can speak more broadly on just budgeting and resource allocation in a general context. Insofar as the politics of this go, I am much more quick to assume members of Congress are feckless than I am for general people. So it's entirely possible that the Republicans were doing this as a tactic and a revenge bill. But I could also see it being a thing where my initial read on Toomey was, it's like, man, this guy's really hung up on this bookkeeping stuff. I don't like that. And Jen has corrected me, but it was my thought at the time that he was trying to have it go, $40 billion is discretionary rather than mandatory. This is very important. If you'll put this bill into law, I'll sign it. And that wasn't happening, which made me think maybe it was going to be a wedge issue, which leadership often does, where they could figure out a way to make the other guys look bad by having something to do with veterans. In a broad budgeting capacity, the things that I would like all members of Congress to keep in mind are, one, Congress ultimately does have to do its job. I understand why we have certain things that are mandatory that Congress doesn't deal with on a regular basis, particularly given how dysfunctional Congress is. But at the same time, that is ultimately the purview of Congress. And part of the problem that I see with making more and more things mandatory spending long term is that it removes the ability of the elected body to allocate those funds as the government would like. And so for an example, there was a funding cut with the Interior Department at one point a few years ago. I think this is like 30 or 40 years ago. And Congress basically said, we're cutting the Interior, the Interior Department's budget by 5%, but we're going to leave it to you guys to determine where you want to do that, which makes sense. You guys know the department better than we do. So what the Interior Department did was it shut down the Washington Monument and it put a sign on the base that said, this is now closed to the public due to congressional budget cuts, to kind of force their hand. Now, for the record, this could be apocryphal, but I think that it indicates my fear of having kind of mandatory administration-based or agency-based spending. The other thing that does worry me here, and I see this with both parties all the time in general, is that we've really abandoned any pretense of the idea that the budget is at some point a limited resource, that there is a limited amount of funding we have to things, and it's our job or it's their job to look at the limited resources and allocate them and say, it would be great if we had twice as much money available to do everything we don't. We have a certain amount of money. So we're going to try and figure out the way to make this as impactful as not. And I feel like we've now shifted to this mindset of we spend based on whether we think it's important. Is it really important that we should spend it? And we'll kind of worry about the math on the backside of it. So when I see guys like Toomey coming up and getting really frustrated about budgets, mandatory spending, discretionary spending, while it's always possible they're being feckless, I do want there to be some accountant gadflies in the room that are keeping track of the books, that are going, yeah, we like, okay, if we're pulling from this, we got to pull from something else too. So yeah, that's kind of my broad take on it.
I guess that makes sense. And I don't like that this wasn't paid for. I don't like when any bills aren't paid for. But we also didn't pay for the wars. So I feel like at this point where Toomey did vote for the wars and the Republicans launched Afghanistan and Iraq, for them to turn around and try and penny pinch on this, that's a big problem for me. Like, we have to take care of the people that went and fought these wars for us. Like, if they want to find the funding for this, how about fewer ships? How about fewer wars? Like, the funding being unlimited for the OCO account, the Overseas Contingency Operations, which were off the books during Republican reign for years, which Toomey wasn't screaming about. Like, that's the issue for me. Like, I'm with you that we need to start budgeting again. But I think the bigger thing to focus on is we are still allocating ever increasing amounts of money for wars, which is creating more veterans, which is going to create more expenses. It makes me endlessly furious that we actually have two separate appropriations for war and then another one for veterans, as if those aren't the same expense. So I think that we just need to start looking at veterans as a war expense. And if we want to do something fiscally responsible to limit our international policing, that's the ultimate way to cost cut. It's not to say, sorry, you got cancer, but we don't have enough money to pay for you. This is one of those where we broke it, we bought it.
All of that sounds good. I don't disagree with any of those assessments or those solutions, Jen. I'll just say, and I don't think this is what you're saying, but a lot of the time the media gets in this trap of getting into, well, if the Republicans did it, then would the Democrats get to do it now and vice versa? Again, I don't think you're saying that. You're not playing the whataboutism thing, but that does happen a lot. And I get very frustrated on that end where I want somebody to be the vice principal. Somebody needs to be the assistant director. Somebody needs to be the bad guy here. And I feel like both parties are now just fiscally incontinent whenever they're approached by something that's important to them, where they go, oh, well, yeah, but in this instance, we have to. And so, well, yeah, but when you add in all those things, then you no longer have an actual budget that works. And at some point, the chickens come home to roost. And so that's my big concern long term.
That's fair.
Politically, let me make this point. When it comes to Toomey, he is doing exactly what he wants. He is no longer going to be serving in Congress after this term. There is currently a race to replace him. He is retiring. So he is in the phase where he isn't doing something for the next election. So whatever he did on this bill is something that I think he does have at least a basic passion for. It is being done because he thinks it's important. That being said, I don't think any of this really matters. And I think Toomey probably kind of in a weird way got thrown under the bus because the Republicans needed a reason why they didn't vote for this bill when in reality, I totally buy what you're saying, Jen, that this was, you know, McConnell felt like he got outfoxed because Manchin went into his hole and he thought that that was going to be it for the reconciliation bill. And then after chips, he popped back up and it's happening. And I think that, this was just a no. All right, we'll make this wait longer because you screwed me, Chuck. And then John Stewarted him.
Well, yeah. And I don't think that Pat Toomey was like a scapegoat in this, because like I said, in every version that passed, even before this, he was voting no. He kept pushing for this amendment. Like, this really was
a
Toomey thing. What switched was that 30 Republicans who had voted for almost the same exact bill decided at that last minute.
Now, like, all of a sudden that Toomey's thing was the reason to not vote for it.
Yeah. Like, Toomey asked for all of this.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, but you know, you know this in Congress, that like people will be making their point, you know, knowing that a thing's going to pass. It weirdly, the more certain a thing is to pass, the more that somebody can feel bold about saying, well, I don't think that this is right. And and that's a thing that they can say.
There were going to be consequences, though, if this was successful, even though this inevitably did become law 6 days later. Like, eventually this is going to be forgotten that this ever happened. But had Toomey been successful, the House is already on vacation, not expected to come back for over a month. So had they changed the bill at all, the House would have had to vote again, which means this is another month of people not getting cancer treatments. And that's life or death consequences for people that have already waited entirely too long. We've already lost people because they didn't get their cancer treatments. So I think that's why there was so much fury. It was just like, this was kind of clearly a political game, but there were people on the other end of this that are waiting for their first treatments. And so I think that's where the fury came from, because the time they decided to dick around while the House is already gone. So just the timing of this was all disgusting and bad as well.
Heaton, any final words?
I think eventually we're going to get to a point where all bills are done last minute at the very end of the year in an oh fuck omnibus, which we're pretty much there. But we'll start calling the oh fuck omnibus the American Responsible Statecraft Investment in Puppies, Veterans, and Anti-Rape Laws Bill of 2028, or whatever the thing is. I think eventually it will be the, oh shit, you have to vote for all these bills that the speaker, whoever it is, did themselves without any input. You have to vote on it, or the whole government's going to fucking shut down and there's going to be an apocalypse. So you got to vote all of it all at once, everything involving veterans and the Department of Agriculture, all of that. And also, if you do vote against it, I don't know if I told you this, we put in the words veterans, puppies, anti-rape, patriotism, investment, anti-inflation in it. So you better do it. And I get frustrated. I don't know. I'm more frustrated with politicians than I am with either party in this scenario.
Well, and what grossed me out is that happens all the time. I've been reporting on it for years. It's always right around Christmas. It infuriates me. And the Republicans who were lying about this vets bill were saying that this bill was one of those cases and expecting that no one would read it and just be like, yeah, every bill has all of this stuff stuck into it and there's slush funds and they do all these things. So they were lying about this bill, saying it's exactly what you're saying. But this is one of those cases where
this was an actual bill pertaining to veterans. Yeah. It didn't have a bunch of extraneous bullshit where it's like, yeah, veterans. But if you look at page 5, it says that we're giving $8 billion to the sugar industry in Florida. Like, you didn't know any of that stuff.
No, it didn't. And I was expecting to see it, honestly. So it was clean.
Which, yeah. To be fair, that's your thing. Like, you fight like every time that I listen to especially one of these, any bill that gets press attention, you know, anything that gets reported on, the next congressional dish is always a thing that's not about the thing that it was talking about. It's always now we're sponsoring pimps cups for all of Congress. Like, everyone's gonna get a bejeweled pimps cup because somebody had the pimps cup lobby in their ear when they were doing the anti-AIDS bill.
The actual legit example that just happened, my episode about the gun law was actually about pharmacy benefit managers and the favor that they got attached to it. Like, it happens all the time.
Oh, wait, hold on. There was a gun law that came out of?
That was the gun law.
That was interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway. Jeez. All right. So there we go. Good. Good for John Stewart. Good for the veterans. Good that Congress got their head out of their ass and passed this thing. I think that this is, by and large, considering all the Sturm und Drang, a good news story.
It is. It is.
There we go. Well, let's hope that this one remains good news. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan this week, marking the first time in 25 years a high-level official has visited the island. Taiwan is a nation of 23 million with a booming electronics industry, although China has another name for it. China. America's solidarity with the 23 million people of Taiwan is more important today than ever, said Pelosi, as the world faces a choice between autocracy and democracy. The battle between the one China policy and America's need to dance between the fact that we support Taiwan, but also have our entire economy based on Chinese labor, has now reached another weird level. The trip was done, by the way, against the warnings of the Biden administration, as some believed it might disrupt the fragile alliance that the State Department reportedly has struck with China not to fund Russia's campaign into Ukraine, specifically drones, which Russia really needs. China builds more than anybody and apparently has not been going to Russia, at least according to unnamed sources who want to be mad about Nancy Pelosi. So let's just send this around. I have three possible reasons why this happened, and I want you to tell me which of the three you believe in the most. Is this a sell job for the recently passed CHIPS Act, the Semiconductor Act, which is heavily predicated on us continuing to buy and source things from Taiwan so we can build them in America? Is it a farewell tour for Pelosi, who is reportedly retiring if the Democrats lose the House and this is the last chance that she's going to be able to play big dignitary? Or is it the beginning of World War III? Heaton?
I'm inclined to go with option B. Option A, I don't know as much about, but why would she need to go over to Taiwan to shore up a bill that pertains to American legislators? Taiwan doesn't have a lot of votes, does it?
Well, so that's the thing. The semiconductor bill is already, if it's not law, it's on Biden's desk and it will be law shortly.
Yeah.
The thing is that Taiwan has taken over most of that industry. We used to produce 40% of semiconductors. We're now down to 12, and that giant sucking sound went straight to Taiwan. That's what took the industry. So the way I see it, Pelosi might be going there to be like, yo, we just passed this into law, but don't worry, we're still going to do business with you. We're not actually competing with you. Like, I think it might be a massaging of the fact that we just made this honestly state sponsoring of industry law. This is what we tell other countries they're not allowed to do, and yet we just did it. So there was some conversations that needed to be had there.
Interesting. Hold on. It wasn't that we were trying to jack up tariffs in order to create semiconductors. We're passing out like subsidies to the semiconductor industry.
No. Now we are saying, hey, the reason why we're outsourcing all this shit is because it's cheaper to do out of the country than it is to do here.
That's how free trade works. They're better at making semiconductors. We're better at making ketchup. We make more ketchup. They make more semiconductors. If we had tariffs, we'd make some semiconductors and some ketchup, and they'd make low quality ketchup. And it all works out better. There's more semiconductors and more ketchup when we have low tariffs and countries can specialize in things and engage in free trade with each other.
Exactly. So, the problem is, what if those cheap semiconductors are coming because of slave labor and you're afraid that the people who are building them are building back doors into the tech for which they can own your machines?
There's also another factor with this one is, what if the island that's making all of your semiconductors is like 5 minutes away from being invaded by China?
There's also that.
Well, so I'm less concerned about the intelligence ramifications of that. It's like the Senate Investment and Foreign, Senate Foreign Investment Intelligence Committee or something to that effect, is fairly scrupulous, at least when there's foreign capital coming into the United States. They're going to buy something that might affect military supply chains. So With Taiwan? Taiwan as slave labor? Are we talking about like
No. China. This was me just largely gesturing to China.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I will point out, Taiwan, according to China, is China. So, like, we are never more than 2 days away from them making that a very hard point.
Well, Taiwan, according to Taiwan, is also China. Like, this is the other thing, too, is that officially both countries recognize there's one China. The disagreement is about who's the real China. If you're talking to China, or what we call China, to Beijing, to the commies, they go, well, these evil fascist capitalists lost the war and set up shop on this island and are hoping to reclaim our country. Whereas the Taiwanese say, well, we were the legitimately democratically elected government of China. We got ran out by all these communists that got funded by Russia, but we're still the legitimate Chinese government. We're democratic China as opposed to the People's Republic of China. And so they both agree on that. And China definitely wants to get Taiwan back like tomorrow, or better yet, tonight. Like they cannot sleep having that there. That's absolutely there. The thing that interests me about this story is just to what extent this is going to have blowback a la Ukraine or for Taiwan itself, versus to what extent are we shoring up allies in East Asia, Southeast Asia. The last 30 years, like going from like Carter on, maybe Nixon on, America adopted a position of strategic ambiguity towards China, where we're allies with Taiwan. We're giving them military aid. We're giving them military assistance. We don't recognize them as an independent country. And we're kind of like, we'd probably protect them, maybe not. And that sort of benefited us because we could do business with both countries. We could say, hey, China, look, we agree. Taiwan is China. Here's what we're asking is, we want to fit up when you eventually merge back into one happy China, we want it to be a peaceful democratic process. But we're not saying it's an independent country, so we can still buy your slave labor microchips or whatever. Meanwhile, Taiwan, we got your back probably in the event that China invades. So, you can also sell us your microchips. Now China's in a different position. I don't know if that strategic ambiguity is a good idea. Kind of my preference where I'm at, I would prefer to give them a bunch of bombs and then get out of there. And basically like short of nuclear weapons, just go here. It's now mutually assured destruction. Neither of you should go into the other one. Don't invade each other because it'll be so horrible for you both. And then we're going to pop off. Goodbye. That's not happening.
We gave them, I think, the Aegis system back in the 2000s. Yeah. So we have been a very reliable arms dealer for Taiwan. Can I give you a little bit of historical trivia? The question of whether or not to defend then Quemoy and Matsu, the now named the Taiwanese islands, was a big topic during the first famous Nixon-Kennedy debate, where Kennedy was on the side of more forcefully defending the islands, and Nixon thought it was youthful folly from Kennedy and that we should be more anti-interventionalist.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and on that note, Taiwan has tried to drag us into a war with China twice. This has been the Taiwanese government has on two different occasions attempted to position us and China into a shooting match, because they gambled that in the event that happened, we would level Beijing and install them as the new government. So there's a lot going on here. I would say that if we're going to be playing this game in Southeast Asia, I think we need to make up our mind about what we're going to do and stick by it. And so in that capacity, I kind of like that she's going over there, because I don't think it's a good idea for us to just be ambiguous and go, oh, maybe we would, maybe we wouldn't. I would rather pick a direction and stick with it. What I would really like to know about Speaker Pelosi's visit is when she planned this, because that to me seems very relevant in terms of the action she should have taken. And what I mean by that is, this isn't a trip to just Taiwan. This is a trip to Taiwan, Singapore. I can't remember Japan,
Korea,
probably South Korea. So like our trade to where?
Also South Korea is where she is right now.
Right. To South Korea. Right. So to our trading partners in Asia. So if this was planned like a year ago, I don't know when it was planned, but if it was planned a year ago, and then now she decided, let's not go to Taiwan because that might interfere with China, a la Russia and Ukraine. That would be sending a message to Taiwan that like, you guys are totally disposable when we're a little bit worried that we're going to piss off China. And I don't know that that's a good idea. Now, conversely, if we did it intentionally to provoke them, that seems like a different state.
So I'm looking at this on like a more big picture level because I'm traveling with my mom right now. And so we were kind of sitting here being like, is this World War III? So I was like watching the whole thing with her and she was just like, I don't get it. Like, why won't the Biden administration tell her to just stay? Like, if they're on the same team, what's happening with them? Like, why is it that she's able to go? And that just stuck with me. And so as I zoom out and look at the big picture, I think they're still playing the strategic ambiguity game because you had them at the same exact moment. You had Pelosi in Taiwan.
Biden saying don't go and she's going. Yeah,
yeah.
Interesting.
She's like the State Department was out there saying over and over again, we still support the One China policy while she's simultaneously meeting with Taiwan's president saying like we're 100% with Taiwan. So you had the same party, the leaders of them.
Yeah.
Doing the opposite things. And so it is mixed messages. It's the same thing we've been doing for 30 years. I think that's all it is. I think they're still playing both sides and we haven't picked a side. And I don't think we intend to anytime soon.
And also I would say maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should be keeping our options open on something like that. Let me go back to this because for audio listeners, when I mentioned that Nancy Pelosi says she's going to retire if the Democrats lose the House, Jen made a bit of a stink face. Do you not believe that is going to happen?
No, she's not going to give up her power. I don't believe that for a second.
So she wants to be minority leader because that is a pretty shitty job.
I don't see her like winning an election and then immediately retiring. Like she's still going to be in charge of the Democratic Party. Like, I don't like predicting the future. So I just like don't even enjoy playing this game. But like I made the stink face because just like Nancy Pelosi like lives off of power. I don't think she's just going to go home and like eat ice cream and die. Like that's just not her game. I think she's going to hold on to power until her teeth fall out of her head and she's dead.
In DC specifically, like yeah. she is going to be in Congress forever because like she faced more of a stiff leadership challenge last time.
Not really this whole thing. Like, no, I don't want to go back and like relitigate what happened with the $15 minimum wage or all that. But like we all knew Nancy Pelosi was going to be the Speaker of the House. It wasn't a real challenge to her leadership. There's too many corporate Democrats that love the money that she brings in. She lives off of this.
She's a machine.
She's a machine. Like, no, I just don't. She's not going anywhere. And we've had a lot of elderly congressmen and senators die in office lately. A lot. These people are hanging on until the very end. And I think she's likely to be one of them.
In fact, I think they know that they will die if they retire. I think they're aware of that. Mm-hmm. Like, who was it? Arlen Specter, like lost the Republican primary in Pennsylvania and then went to the Democratic primary in Pennsylvania, got beat out in the generals and like died a month after leaving office. Like when your whole life and like, I totally get it. I'm an extrovert who loves shaking hands and meeting people and doing policy wonkery. I would love being a legislator. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then you pull the plugs on that and you're like, oh, you can read a book now. Like I could see how that would kick the legs out from under you.
Nancy should worry about dying too, because presumably if she retires, she's going to have to drive with her husband. Go ahead, Jen.
True. I just can't imagine having more than like $125 million in the bank and not being like, I'm going to spend the rest of my years, which for her less than 20 for sure. Like go have fun. Go spend the whole time on the biggest yacht you can find. Go travel the world without having to take these damn meetings. Like, enjoy your life. And instead, she's just one of these like power hungry. Like,
She is traveling the world. She's on a CODEL right now where she gets to meet heads of state, the heads of government.
But not,
she gets to do all the traveling plus all the pomp with a bunch of aides and buddies.
They had her name in lights on the side of a skyscraper in Taiwan. I don't think that she gets that if she just shows up on Delta.
Yeah. They're not doing that for Paul Ryan if he shows up.
She has over $100 million. She can still have a staff the entire time. She can pay to have a billboard with her own name. Like, she can pay to have all these things without any of the responsibility. And she chooses because she's a power hungry. So I just, the idea that she's going to be like, oh, I'm done.
So, all right. So just you said you don't want to predict the future. I will say, at least according to the stuff that I read that is very plugged into Congress, there is currently a very active shadow contest to see who is going to be the next leader of the Democratic Party in the House. Among the names, Hakeem Jeffries seems to be the leader in the clubhouse. Next to him, Adam Schiff, which, oh, good Lord. When she got that this latest turn as Speaker, it came with the promise that this was her last go round. So if you don't want to predict the future, let's litigate the past. Do you believe that that was disingenuous?
I don't. So she only promised to not be Speaker again, which I don't entirely believe. But the idea that she's retiring, like, are you hearing that she's retiring from Congress? Because that's what I'm hearing you say. Or are you just saying she's retiring from being the Speaker?
What I have heard from people that cover Congress is that the move would be, because I think she's up for election in November.
Everybody is.
Despite the fact that nobody I ever met in the Bay Area ever had a kind word to say about Nancy Pelosi, she still wins by Saddam Hussein margins every time that she's up for election. What I heard was that she will win, and then she will have somebody that she wants to be appointed in it. But if she can't lead the party, she doesn't have interest in being in Congress.
Ugh, that's so selfish. Hold on. I'm so angry about that as a former Bay Area resident, because she was going to put us through a special election because of her own fucking ego. Like, if that's true, I'm going to hate her even more. That's so awful. Like, if you want to retire, retire.
The Bay Area will hate her so much, they'll vote for her even harder.
I know.
She'll win by 60%.
Honestly. These super liberal people, they vote for the most corporate woman.
I think that there's an absolute certainty that if somebody's on the fence, particularly a high-powered member of Congress, and they know that it's a slam dunk election, they're absolutely going to do that and force. And if they decide to drop out, force a special election, right? Like, that'll absolutely happen. They're going to keep she's going to keep the options open. It would just to have that in there and then make you guys go through a special election if necessary. I think that's a certainty.
Well, because she's not going to leave now when there still is a possibility she's Speaker of the House. Like it is unlikely that the Democrats are going to keep the House. But you never know, any given Sunday and all that. So, like, if she still has the chance to be Speaker, she's not going to give that up.
But doesn't that go back to her promise from the beginning of this Congress that she wouldn't be Speaker again? So doesn't that automatically, like, she's either breaking her promise and she's going to stay Speaker, or that promise was always a lie.
Well, she's certainly on the ballot. She is on the ballot in this upcoming election.
All I know is that she's causing trouble in Taiwan.
On that note, real quick, before we finish up on Taiwan, I've done stand-up over there. I did stand-up in Taipei.
Really?
And I hung out for a couple of... it was one of the more surreal moments of my comedy career. I was doing stand-up in Taipei and then, like, just went and hung out with all these Taiwanese comedians and drank Suntory whiskey out of plastic cups underneath an overpass. Like, it wasn't glamorous, but it was very like, man, I'm definitely an international comedian right now, drinking the Suntory whiskey with my new friends under this overpass. The funny thing, though, that I liked about Taiwan that I thought was amazing. So Chiang Kai-shek was their big guy, right? So you've got Chairman Mao, Chiang Kai-shek, they're squaring off. Chiang Kai-shek is the putatively capitalist, putatively democratic one. Mao is the commie. Chiang Kai-shek gets run over to Taiwan and is just a dictator for the rest of his life. Like, if I had to pick, I'd prefer Chiang Kai-shek over Mao, because Mao's just margin of death was so amazing that Chiang Kai-shek was still, like, not a fun, fuzzy, pleasant, democratically elected president. He's a dictator for the entirety of his life. There was a law in Taiwan while he was president for life that every town had to have a statue of him in its town square. So when he died, they eased up on that and they said, here's the new rule. If you want to keep your Chiang Kai-shek statue in the middle of the town, you can. If you want to get rid of it, we'll come take it from you. And what they did is all the towns that were like, yeah, fuck this guy, he's a dictator. They rounded up all these statues and they put it in a park near where he's buried. And the weird thing is, in statue form, Chiang Kai-shek looks just like Patrick Stewart. So I went to check this out and it's like the Patrick Stewart sculpture garden. You're just walking around and there's at least 300 Patrick Stewart statues, like saluting, waving, sitting. Like it's really surreal. And meanwhile, Chiang Kai-shek isn't actually buried. He's in an above ground coffin because when he died, he specified in his will that he wanted to be buried in Beijing after they took back the mainland. So he's only temporarily interred in Taiwan above ground until which time he can be taken to his proper tomb in China.
I'll tell you what, I feel like we have our next international basement recording. So anybody in Taipei, if you're listening to this, hit us up.
Go get that Suntory. I'll meet you under pass 42.
All right. We have a lot of emails. So let's keep this third story pretty fast. In the Washington Post this week, the Forward Party added a few new propellant elements. David Jolly, a former Republican congressman, and Christine Ty Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey, joined with Andrew Yang, saying that they represented the three planks of the political movement that have now decided they will not be failed by the Republican and Democratic parties anymore. Heaton, you are our resident third party defender. It seems
Yang
to me
fan.
That
unabashed Andrew Yang fan. Yeah.
And an unabashed Yang fan. It seems to me that the Forward Party is for not being the Republican Party and not being the Democratic Party.
Oh shit. That sounds awful, Justin. Please continue.
But even in this op-ed, I don't see much else of what they're for. Is it enough to just define yourself as being not your enemy, or do you need to be a little something yourself?
So let's separate this into two things. The op-ed, I don't think the op-ed was very good. The only the best part of the op-ed was just reading the bios of the people participating in it. The op-ed said what we've all known for a long time when you look at any polling, which is that about half the country is now independent. It's like there are more independents than there are Republicans or Democrats. There's a reason for this. People feel alienated. There's an exhausted majority, which is not catered to by other party. All true, but I've heard it many times before. I think that the title of the piece was why all other third parties fail and we will not. And I didn't see the definitive reason therein of why they wouldn't,
me either.
Which was a rather big omission. However, do note that a lot of the time editors, I don't know how it is for guest op-eds, but usually editors write the headlines rather than the writers. So perhaps that was something that the Washington Post was
100% of everything.
Right.
The editors write it. Yeah.
So there's okay. So my guess is that's the Washington Post and Yang probably had something a bit more wonky. I think this is a great idea. We are uncatered to. There are more than two opinions in the United States. There are more than two positions. There ought to be more than two political parties. And like, whereas a lot of my time was spent hanging out with the Libertarian Party, which is a very doctrinaire, very ideological specific party. There's a ton of people that are just moderates and centrists that are now going, I am not catered to by any of these groups of people. And I'll add to this, somebody needs to be pushing electoral reform. We need that. This is, I used to have the opinion that, we're really partisan and rancorous right now because American culture is a pendulum and it'll swing back to everybody being, I'm not confident in that anymore. I now think that there are fundamental systemic issues that are resulting in members of Congress becoming more and more extreme on both sides. I don't think it's just a weather pattern or a mood or a season. I think there are fundamental structural reasons this is happening. And if they keep working that way, and there's no reason they wouldn't keep working that way, we're going to keep becoming more partisan. We're going to have more and more people that feel disenfranchised from the political process. We're going to have more and more people that think the system's bullshit. And these are not good outcomes. So I want somebody to be coming in and changing that system. And the Forward Party is doing two things that I think are very interesting. One, they're really just pushing electoral reform. Andrew Yang was very big on UBI. I suspect that that's a plank within the Forward Party. It's not what they're talking about. They're talking about ranked choice voting, open primaries, ending gerrymandering. All three good things to do in tandem to fix American democracy. The other thing they're doing is they're saying, you can be a Democrat and join the Forward Party. We're a polyamorous political party. You can be a Republican and join us. You can be a Libertarian. And they have examples of all of these people participating in it, which is different than most third parties have operated the last few years. Some of them do that, but they're advertising it more openly. I wish them the best with this. And I don't see the Republican Party or the Democratic Party making big electoral reforms because they like the current setup. They like having the American people choose between the lesser of two evils. They don't want to actually have to compete on ideas. They don't want to have to compete on governance. They want to compete on fear and hate. And I want no part of that. So if Andrew Yang and the Forward Party wants to come in and offer me an alternative to that bullshit duopoly, great. And if they can fix the electoral system, even better.
Jen?
I didn't know anything about the Forward Party. And this is one of those instances where Andrew knows far more than I do. And if everything he says is true, which I know, Andrew, you do your homework. I'm in. That sounds great. Because I've said forever that we're not as divided as we're told. And the rot at the core of our system is the way that we elect our representatives. And if we could fix that, then all the other issues, there's definitely common ground to be found. I have no doubt. But like, as long as that is rotting, then we're in trouble. So if that's their key issue, I don't think it really matters what they think about war or climate change or economics or any of the other issues right now. We have to fix the rot first. And if that's their goal, I'm down.
You want to know what would help force electoral reform? Third parties with defined positions that the other two parties won't touch.
Like electoral reform?
Yeah. I mean, that's what
because it sounds like that's what they're pushing, and it's definitely not what the Republicans and Democrats are pushing.
No, because you need a thing that says a issue beyond the election itself that people will want to go vote for a person and they can't, or that person can't get on the ballot. That's what forces electoral reform.
Yeah, but the Forward Party is not looking to establish itself as a permanent feature that for 1,000 years will reign in America. They're looking to blast apart the system and reform it in a more more governable, competent way.
Good, congratulations. Then I look forward to grading their essay, so I can say amazing dream casting. I hope they are practitioners of the secret. They are going to write their goals on the wall and hope to manifest them through good thoughts and the Care Bear stare.
Wait. I just heard some very specific goals. I heard ranked choice voting. I heard,
open primaries and gerrymandering.
All three of those things I'm voting yes on.
We can have the ranked choice voting conversation at another time. I don't think it's the panacea that people tend to make it out to be. All I'm saying is this: the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are gangs. They are mob families. They exist because whether or not we find them palatable, they issue a brand of opinions for which a broad coalition of people want to go out and vote. They maintain their power because they have ballot access, money, and branding and fame for which they can delegate to people that do not have the kind of name recognition that people will vote for them just because the brand is on it. You do not break up that power by saying, please make the rules better. You break up that power by creating another gang that eats up turf for which the parties soften on these issues, or the populace says that we need to have a better access to these ideas for which the other two gangs won't touch. That's the only way that this works.
Right. So, yes, I am in agreement with you that you don't get electoral reform from power centers by politely asking the power centers to relinquish power. That is a losing strategy. I agree with that. However, I think what you're basically saying is Andrew Yang needs to be Kaiser Soze. Like, he's the new guy on the block and he needs to just go fuck up some people.
No. You need to have issues.
Right. And they do. So one of the things that was outlined and said op-ed is they counter this whole idea of a spoiler vote, right? Or a spoiler. Because it's going to come up. And what they said is, you can't spoil a system that's already spoiled. I take that as them telegraphing that they're planning to run spoiler candidates, that they're not going to be apologetically stepping back and saying, oh, we can't do this. No, I think what they're going to also do is trying to get people to run as Democrats and as Forward Party people and run as Republicans and as Forward Party people, which might be a smart way to do this, given that both parties are going to do everything in their power to stop a third party from participating. But they might run some just straight up Forward Party candidates too. And that would kind of be my thing. Is I think that if you want to get electoral reform going, what you basically need to do is find the actual swing districts. And like I proposed, have I mentioned Joker PAC on here before? If there's any billionaires listening, I would like to form Joker PAC. Joker PAC would be pushing these same electoral reform issues. And what we would do is just try to create spoiler candidates in swing districts just to fuck things up. And we'd go, hey, if you put these in, we can't fuck things up anymore. Like, cause the Republicans, Democrats really like having they don't actually like competitive democracy. They like having designated Republican districts, designated Democratic districts. And then when there is a swing district, they're like, you guys stay the fuck out. We got to deal with this right now. So if you come in and you go, well, we're just going to fuck it up. We don't even care what happens. But if you pass these electoral reforms, then we can't, we're toothless at that point. So that might happen. I'm not sure that they're not going to be doing that. They've got a party conference or something coming up. I'm in Edinburgh. Otherwise I would go to it because I think it's in Texas.
Let me ask you this. When they run those candidates, their number one issue is going to be electoral reform, or is it going to be something that people actually give a fuck about?
People do give a fuck about that. I don't know why you think they don't.
That doesn't get a fucking actual people out of their doors. They care about the economy. They care about healthcare. They care about shit that actually fucking moves people to the ballot box.
I have spoken to so many people, Democrat, Republican, and other, over the last 4 years, where when I say, like, yeah, I host this show, it's called The Political Orphanage, I'm very tired of the red team versus blue team thing, and they just, like, have palpable relief and go, yes, I agree, right? The exhausted majority is a thing. There are people that this actually speaks to. It's not just pointy-headed, wonky folks like us. There are actual people that are going, I'm not represented by this. The democracy that we're quote-unquote participating in is warped and rigged, and that is an issue in and of itself. Electoral reform is an issue. The Civil Rights Act was an issue. That's electoral reform. That's an issue.
I could not disagree with you more.
Well, I think you like having the Democrats versus Republicans because you've made a whole career on being referees between their bullshit, and you like being able to call it. So spoilers, screws with your game.
No, I'm here. I'm here to break them up, but break them up in the way that works.
Okay, and what Andrew just said, they're going to put people in as moles in the gang. So, like, I don't know. It's worth a shot.
Well, we'll see. That's him fan fictioning it. But maybe if that happens, then at least that would be a plan, which is more than what we've seen in this op-ed or anything else that's come out of the Forward Party.
So to back up a little bit, because I do pay attention to third parties. I find them interesting. I know a lot of people in third parties. Basically, it seems to me there's two third party approaches right now to trying to shake up the system, just in terms of appealing to mass groups of people. One is hyper ideological. And this is the direction the Libertarian Party is going. Particularly now, there's a lot of in-party stuff with the Mises Caucus, et cetera, but they're trying to Tea Party their way at this moment into being effective on the national scene of, we are going to be so clear and clarion in our very specific ideology that we will appeal to the people that think that the Republican and Democratic parties are soupy nonsense and is not our ideological thing. We're going to go for those people. We're going to be a lightning rod for the ideologues. That's how the libertarians are doing it, at least now. The other way to do it, and you saw this very, very ineffectively in 2020, was with the kind of coalitional hodgepodge thing of what was the Alliance Party. And the Alliance Party went, we're going to go for the center. Rather than trying to find disaffected ideologues that don't have an ideological core in the Republican or Democratic Party, we're going to look for the moderates and the centrists who are being left behind by both. What they tried to do, which I thought was an interesting thing, was they tried to team up with all the third parties that exist on a state level. So they'd go into like Kansas and go, oh, apparently the Bull Moose Party is a thing here. Well, tell you what, you should get on the Alliance wagon. And then we'll go into Florida and we'll find like the everybody gets a new hat on Thursday's party or whatever. And they try to kind of cobble this together, and it didn't do anything, right? It was their guy got very low votes. I think in terms of where a third party could really make an impact right now is more to appealing to moderates and centrists who are numerically higher and also demonstrably pissed off and alienated than going the ideological route. So far, I think the Forward Party is making a good call. And I think that their strategy of having candidates that run as a Democrat, Republican, or Libertarian while also championing these things is basically a way of saying, we're going to create a caucus like you do in Congress within the existing power structure to reform the existing power structure. That makes sense to me.
I like everything you're saying. All of it.
And if that's what they said in the op-ed, maybe I would think better of them. But this is Andrew Heaton saying what he would do if he were running the Forward Party.
Heaton, maybe you should write to them.
I'm in contact with some people. I'm not doing a lot of fan fiction there. I mean, this is my understanding. Like, I interviewed Andrew Yang on my show. Like, I interviewed him about 6 months ago and talked to him about what they're trying to do, what the Forward Party is, the electoral reforms we just talked. We just talk about UBI a lot because that's what he was primarily known for. But like what they're looking to do in terms of it. And like, this is as best as I can recall, I'm relaying what I learned from him.
I still think that you need issues. And I don't think that if you go to the disaffected, exhausted majority and you ask them in order the shit that they care about, that electoral reform, while they might care about it, while they might say that they care about it. And I don't think that they're being disingenuous. I don't think that these are absolute loser issues. I'm just saying that it's going to come after about 10 different things that affect them on a daily basis.
I just think that Americans are smarter than that. Like, we know that there's a broken system. So to call fixing a broken system like a lack of an issue, like, that is an issue. For me, it's the core issue. And for so many people that feel like these two parties are not representing us, like, I think you're underestimating how many people care about the system.
If we go into a recession and people don't have jobs and inflation's still going on, and they are worried about feeding their kids, that's going to the number one issue is going to be ranked choice voting.
Justin, you're leaving out an important part of this, which is that, as I understand it, a lot of the people going to be running Forward Party will be running as Republicans and Democrats on those exact issues that you're outlining. So you're seeing a situation where, in a tight race between a Republican and a Democrat, if one of them also goes Forward Party, they're still running on how to beat inflation. They're still running on all that stuff. But they go, and also, I'm in favor of all these electoral reform things. I want to fix the system. Then you get all the benefit of them bandwagoning on. Like, we used to have back in the 19th century, you'd have like the Democratic Party and the populists would team up, or the Republicans in a few instances and the populists would team up. So in this situation, I don't see how it's a bad thing to have a Republican and a Democratic candidate, and one of them's in favor of electoral reform. Therefore, they get the endorsement of the Forward Party. And then people like me go, well, good. That's the tiebreaker for me. I'm going to vote for that guy.
I don't necessarily think that that is the best strategic way to go about it. I think that if you're going to run a third party, you need to run a third party with candidates from that third party. And that third party needs to have issues for which show don't tell, have the exhausted majority on their side, because either of the two main parties will touch it because they are too extreme.
I don't think that's going to work. Let me tell you why. There's voter suppression, right? We talk about that. Like ballot suppression is a thing too. Both parties intentionally designed state law to stop any new parties from actually competing. So why not do their current model and have them have an overlapping Venn diagram of Republicans and Democrats who are able to run in the duopoly and have these side issues?
And again, a candy cane world where those two parties aren't going to kill those candidates in the crib because they're probably going to be lower name recognition. And unless the Forward Party is giving them money, right? Look, there are real ways that you run, right? There is money, there is staffing. And unless the Forward Party is going to be funding them in opposition to the parties that they are ostensibly trying to represent, if they are running as Republicans and Democrats, then they are just going to get run over because the Republican and Democratic Party are going to make sure that in those primaries, they are running loyal people, not traitors in their contests. I mean, I don't know, but now we're down the road into hypotheticals. I wish that there was more direction from them, because I do think that there is a moment here. And I don't think that those issues are unimportant. I just think that they are not the most important. And I don't think that you win elections based on those issues.
I don't think that the independents that feel politically homeless are so homogenous that you're going to have a party that represents all of us. Like, I like having an issue that really can unite us, like electoral reform, to unite us, and then we can split off after that into whatever makes sense. But we're too different.
Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong is where you go to support this show. You can also write into us, We're Not Wrong Pod@gmail.com. In that Berlin basement, we asked for Jen Briney love. And oh my God. Oh my good God. Did we get a parade of Jen Briney love? I sent you all of the actual emails, so I'm only going to read one sentence from some of them that we got, but it was by far the most email that we've ever gotten for any episode. I'm going to read all these and then I'm going to ask you your reaction here, Jen. I'm a huge fan of Jen because she is everything I wished progressives were. I just wanted to tell Jen that though I almost find myself on the opposite viewpoint of her policy-wise, I would be much less likely to listen to the show if she were not on it. Again, these are all different emails. I'm reading one sentence from each email. I have a bone to pick with Jen. You're too awesome to be doing a podcast with these two chuckle fucks. Hello, I wanted to email in mostly because I found it extremely coincidental that I'm also married to a solar engineer. Even when she's impassioned, she sticks to verified data and is quick to admit the rare occasion where she misinterpreted the information. Plus, she sounds like a delight to drink with. And finally, Jen is my favorite of you three due to the sheer volume of views that she states that I very agree with and the energy with which she expresses them. Jen, do you feel the love?
I do. And thank you guys. And I can take the heat, but I very much prefer this. So thank you very much. And I don't know if I'm a delight to drink with. I think I'm trouble, but I don't know, boys. What do you think? Am I fun?
You're both. You're a delightful trouble,
Jim.
You're
a delight. Trouble. You're a delight.
Wait, can I just tell people, literally on two occasions when we were in Berlin, we would all go drinking. And then like, I would go like, well, I'm going to head back to the homestead. And Jen would just press on. She made friends with somebody on a subway and then just went drinking with them till like 4 a.m. Like just made friends with some random German dude and went to, I believe, 3 different pubs after we'd all gone home. So yes, Jen is delightful trouble to
Roberto
go hanging out
from
with.
From Mexico City.
Yeah. Although they were all closed, right?
Yes, that's why we went to three.
It was a fruitless quest.
We walked around the train station for about half an hour and then called it. So it wasn't that long of a night, but yeah, I am trouble. But thank you, everyone. That was really sweet of you, and I love to hear it.
It was delightful. We went out after the show and we drank with the people that were there with us. And
it was really cool, by the way. Shout out to everybody. I really enjoyed that. That was magical. That was really nice for everybody 100%. That came out with us.
A frugal climatology maven writes, I'm a graduate student in climate science specializing in carbon capture. As such, my ears picked up when Heaton mentioned donating money to plant trees in Madagascar. To me, there are a couple red flags to that concept. There's a long history of forestry-based carbon offset schemes that turn out to be scams, especially in the global south, far from any regulation or oversight. These can range from getting paid to preserve forests that were never under threat to poorly managed plantations that are mostly dead within 3 years of creation. I'm not saying that all carbon offsets are scams or that Heaton necessarily is getting duped, but it is a common practice that one needs to watch out for. Generally, the lower cost per ton of CO2 offset, the more likely it is to be a grift. Heaton, are you getting robbed?
Could be. No, that's a really good point. And I would advise everybody to be careful with your money. While I am attempting to put my money where my mouth is, I am not doing it as an indulgence that has no effect. I actually do want to make the world better. And for anybody else that is doing their own thing or following suit, don't throw your money in the bushes. This isn't about signaling to people. It's about trying to make the world better. So your head's in the exact right place. These are the exact questions you should be asking. And given your academic background, you would probably know better than me. Feel free to reach out to me personally. I believe the group that I'm going with is the Eden Project out of Madagascar. The factors you bring up are I would say it's not just grift. There's also just basic, like, is this going to work things? The reason I went with the Global South is because I can spend I can have more trees planted cheaper in Madagascar than I can in like Oklahoma or Idaho or something like that. Plus there's other considerations of which trees process the most carbon and are the most carbon intensive. So like, you don't want to be doing, I'm going to get this all screwed up here, but I think like pine trees are not as good as mangrove trees. So you want to go with something that where you get bang for your buck. And then one of the big problems that's happened is, even when it's not a scam, say like you can spend, I don't know, $100 and that will preserve an acre in the rainforest, and a timber company won't buy it. And that's true. They'll just swerve around it and bulldoze that acre next to it, in which case you've done nothing. You've just given, you've given some money to somebody, but there's been no actual change in the amount of trees there. Then there are other things like, is this in a fire plain? Is this in a flood plain? Because if it all gets knocked out, it's for naught, right? The trees don't actually become productive in terms of oxygen until 10 years after their saplings. All of these are very, very reasonable things to bring up. On my end, what I did was I looked at various options. I found one that had a high rating on Charity Navigator that seemed to have some level of oversight with funding, and I went with that one. However, if it is that I'm getting duped, I would love to put my money in a better place. My friend Jeremiah Johnson over the Neoliberal podcast recommended I buy stock in timber companies, because his logic was, look, they want renewable trees. Like they want to keep having a product. I like the idea of the charity more than becoming a guy that puts $300 of timber stock in my portfolio every year, but maybe I could be pushed that direction. So feel free to reach out. If you got a better way, I'm open to it.
A listener with trust issues writes, I'd like to point out that Justin Robert Young made a very broad statement about how gain of function research is somehow a good thing, and he is objectively wrong. Although he admits that gain of function research could be used for good, he caveats this with a statement that we need to trust those in charge. I truly wish I lived in Justin's youthfully innocent reality where we could trust our elected officials, but history has proven otherwise. I wish I were wrong in saying this, but every government in the history of forever has proven that those in power are not trustworthy enough to be allowed to determine which diseases should be allowed to evolve to pandemic level super diseases or to be eradicated. Listen, dipshit. I kid. Mostly. Look, I didn't say any of that. And if you think that my point was that we need to trust the government, my point is that we cannot trust governments to not do it without telling us. They are going to do it, and either we are going to be a part of it or we are not going to be a part of it. So if you believe that us saying gain of function research is illegal, that China is going to stop doing it, then sure, you live in your blissful, youthful ignorance, because I don't think that that's going to stop them. And if anything, when we talk about the American funding for the Wuhan Institute of Virology, I can understand the basic underlying philosophy to it, that you want to have at least some element of buy-in there. Now, where the rubber met the road and something escaped from there, theoretically, hypothetically, and caused a global shutdown, and we weren't able to leverage any of that buy-in for any kind of transparency from China, should let you know even more that we should probably be doing this more in areas that we can totally control, and we should be using every lever at our disposal to try to force transparency where we can. I don't think that transparency is given because we ask nicely, much in the same way that I don't feel like the duopoly will give up on stuff unless you beat them into submission. You need to use any kind of economic or social blackmail that you can to get what you want out of people. Thank you for writing it.
Well put. So buy timber stock.
I was going to be like, oh, be nice to Justin. Like, he's not wrong. And then you came in hot with, okay, dipshit. I was like, okay, he doesn't need me here.
Meanwhile, I'm forming a nonprofit with my person. They're going to reach out. We'll figure out a way to play
it. No. The one thing, look, the one slander I will not, if I've built my entire brand on not trusting anybody, the one slander I will not stand is that Justin trusts people too much. That is the one thing for which I will, that is a line you cannot cross.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right, Jen, what do you got working on?
So, spoiler alert, most of the stuff that I told you about today is going in in my next episode about the Veterans Health Bill. However, one of the reasons I wanted to do a whole episode on it was they have created all new categories of veterans that are now eligible for healthcare because of things they participated in, countries where there were burn pits that I didn't know we had troops in, events like nuclear disasters that I didn't know happened. So I'm chasing down all those rabbit holes just to tell you and myself, like, these things happened. So all the details of the political stuff, the bill, and all my rabbit holes are in the next episode.
Heaton?
I have been studiously going through case law involving separation of church and state. The recent Supreme Court decision, Kennedy v. Bremerton, appeared to open the door on prayer in public schools. I'm fascinated by this topic, and I'm going down rabbit holes on how courts determine whether or not you should be given a religious exemption for things. So, for example, like Native Americans, if you're part of the Native American church, you're allowed to legally take peyote as a sacrament. But like, also, you can't say taxes are against my religion and not pay taxes, which many people have tried, by the way. There's multiple court cases where someone has said, I consider taxes a sin. I should not be required to do them. It violates free exercise of religion. So I'll be doing that next week. This week, I had on Sam Moyne, who wrote a book called Humane, and an interesting premise to it. I'm not sure how I feel about this, but basically He's kind of positing that the more warfare becomes humane, distant, logistically easy, not visceral, the more likely we are, even though it's more humane, the more likely we are to use it frequently and not in conflicts quickly. So we're playing around those ideas, and it's an interesting chat.
If you want to hear a conversation...
Oh. On my show, The Political Orphanage.
There we go. There we go. If you want to hear a conversation with me and a lovely woman by the name of Sarah Rumpf, who now writes for Mediaite, but in a former life was the communications director for Evan McMullen's presidential campaign back in 2020, therefore knows a lot about third party politics.
Third party run.
And she agrees with me about the forward party. You can listen to the most recent episode of Politics, Politics, Politics out now. Kevin Ryan is going to be on the Friday edition, which is what I have to do right for this. So it will be very, very fun every time that Kevin's on. Hey, Kevin's another person that needs to join us on this show. I think he would.
I need to have I've not had Kevin on my show yet. Kevin's a mensch. He's a fun guy. Kevin and I were buddies in Tulsa, and I would he'd just call me and be like, hey, 8 o'clock, man, you want to come over? And I'd come over and he'd be like, cool, man, I stayed at Pop Brownie. And then he'd talk about Tolstoy or something. He's one of the most amazing, smart, but crazy high people I've ever met. He's a cool guy.
See, Andrew, give Pod a chance.
Yeah.
You're right. I should.
It was the only time that anybody has offered me a 10 milligram edible on the tarmac waiting for Air Force One when we were both covering Trump's Tulsa rally. No, he is the best. All right. That wraps it up for us today. For Andrew Heaton, for Jen Briney, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.